Hello, this is Hillel Tekton in the fourth podcast that we are doing in this series in 2013. Today I'd like to look at one of the forms which the crisis is taking. Overall, the crisis has taken a general form of an apparent banking crisis with a much more important underlying form which generally hasn't been discussed in too great a detail. I'm not going to discuss that now. What I want to discuss is instead the particular form that the crisis has taken in Europe. Now, in Europe, we have both immediate forms of the crisis, that is to say, we have a banking crisis and a country crisis, a sovereign crisis. So, what I want to ask is this question. Can the EU survive in modern capitalism? And can the Eurozone survive? In relation to the second question, can the Eurozone survive? At the moment, if most people were asked the question, they would be hard put to provide a straight answer. At the moment, if one is forced to answer, one would have to say, well, it might survive a few years, but it's unlikely to last the way it is going. So, the question therefore is, what are the forces underlying the possible breakup of the Eurozone and the limits of the EU itself, the European Union? Well, with regard to the second question, it's quite clear that if the Eurozone continues to expand the way it is, and it is a condition for new members entering the European Union, that they should get ready to join the Eurozone. It is therefore a problem for those members of the European Union who either find it difficult to join the Eurozone at this time or simply don't want to join the Eurozone. The country which has expressed itself most clearly in relation to this point is the United Kingdom, where the Conservative Party in particular, but not just the Conservative Party, have decided to go for a referendum on the issue by 2017. That's to be a referendum as to where the United Kingdom stays in the European Union or whether it does not. The fact that there should be such an issue is itself of considerable importance. Now, one of the reasons why it's worth just briefly saying something about this, because the issue is much less important than what is happening to the Eurozone, is that the particular form it's taking in Britain does illustrate some of the dynamics of what is actually occurring in the Eurozone itself. Now, why on earth would British business, British big business, want to leave the European Union? After all, it's not the Eurozone. Britain has its own currency, the pound. No one's proposing that it change. And that's been particularly important in this crisis, making it highly unlikely that Britain really has a financial problem, in spite of what the government is saying. So, who is asking for this? Again, if one turns to big business, why would they want it? Surely they want the customs union involved. Surely they want to be part of that, and not outside it. Surely they want to ensure that any investment that might come to Europe could consider Britain and not wonder whether to invest in Britain because there will be a tariff against it since Britain would have left the European Union. All those points have been aired, and it's quite clear that at least either big business as a whole or a substantial section of big business is in favour of the European Union, or rather in favour of Britain staying in the European Union. The Prime Minister, Conservative Prime Minister, wanted to stay in but changed certain rules, certain laws that have been enacted, most particularly those which have protected workers in employment. Well, one might have thought that big business might be in two minds about that, but that's not at all clear. That's to say, it would be wrong to simply say that the bourgeoisie is against laws protecting workers. On the contrary, it would make far more sense from the point of view of an intelligent businessman that workers' rights be clearly enacted and protected, so that you won't get one firm, as it were, undercutting another by reducing workers' rights at any particular time. Usually it's a firm which is in more trouble, which ultimately ceases to exist, so making it worse for the rest of business, as it were. So the point is that, in general, business has tended to favour the existence of unions, even if they want to pick a kind of union, as it were, or a union which isn't political, a union which protects the workers but doesn't go too far, etc. Nonetheless, that has been the tendency. So, simply the fact the European Union has limited the number of hours that can be worked, which after all is a perfectly reasonable demand, would hardly seem to be a reason to leave the Union. And indeed, it is difficult to believe that big business actually does want to leave the European Union. What is true is that there is a division in the bourgeoisie between those who relate more closely to America and those who relate more closely to the European Union as a whole, or, in other words, business on the continent. And it is the case that the industry which remains important in Britain, that's to say, the defence industry and pharmaceuticals in particular, relate very closely to the United States. So there is a certain balance there within the bourgeoisie, and they might, therefore, you might think, want to be closer to the United States than the European Union. And that is true. It's clearly true of a section of the bourgeoisie. But that doesn't mean to say that it would be possible to have some unity with the United States. The United States has made it very clear that it doesn't want it, that it wants Britain to be part of the European Union. This has been the policy of the United States all along, for decades, and Obama has repeated it. So, we are therefore left with looking elsewhere than the bourgeoisie itself, as it were, the central bourgeoisie. And this gets to the heart of the problem, that it would appear that it is much more smaller capital, not less of really just very small capital, but smaller capital, medium-sized capital, perhaps the so-called small and medium-sized enterprise, the SMEs so-called, who prefer that Britain leave the European Union and its rules. It would, after all, allow them to be protected. They would have to deal with any tariffs against Britain. But on the other hand, they could have tariffs against the EU, and perhaps that is what they want. They also want to remove the protection for workers. So in other words, they have the classic demands of a small business. And the Conservative Party depends to a much greater degree on this layer of the population. That's to say, relatively small business and sections of workers who are dependent on it. So, the Conservative Party, therefore, is responding to this kind of demand. And they tend to be more concentrated in the south of the United Kingdom. So not surprisingly, it's these areas where the Conservative Party is strong, and it's not surprising, therefore, that you get this tremendous pressure from the south of Great Britain within the Conservative Party. So I think we should rather understand this demand to leave the EU as what would have been called in earlier times when there was a petty bourgeoisie, a petty bourgeois demand, or a non-big business demand, which has already been made clear in Britain when Esseltine wrote clearly that Britain should not leave the EU, and the Liberal Party would tend to express this viewpoint too. And indeed, the dominant part of the Labour Party. That's to say, the viewpoint of big business itself. Now, this means, of course, that we have this curious position of this middle layer, or this lower layer of the bourgeoisie, being the tail which is wagging the dog. That's the same Conservative Party and Britain itself. And one would have to explain that itself in terms of the class structure of Britain today and the relative weakness of the bourgeoisie. That's to say that it allowed Britain to get to this pass. Because in one sense, it is not just as it were, wrong from the point of view of the bourgeoisie, and therefore in terms of the capitalist country, but it is distinctly idiotic to be going along this line of leaving the EU. Now, let's turn to the European Union, where again there is a division within the EU itself, where you might have thought that it would be a similar division to the one in Britain. Well, of course, that is there. But it's not expressed in exactly the same way or form. Because it's clear that the German bourgeoisie, not just the smaller bourgeoisie in Germany, but the German bourgeoisie as a whole, is supporting the line of the Conservative Party there, which threatens to break up the European Union effectively. Or at the very least, as one commentator has pointed out, that the adoption by Merkel of austerity and pursuing it, as it were, to its end, logically leads to the position where ultimately the squeeze is so great that you begin to get rebellion within the countries of the Eurozone, as you now have effectively one way or another on a small scale, perhaps, in Greece. So, the fact is that in Germany, Merkel does represent the viewpoint of the bourgeoisie itself. And the author I'm referring to wrote an article, that's John Plender, in the Financial Times in August last year, 2012, to the effect which I quoted. So, we have, therefore, the German bourgeoisie openly putting forward a policy which is clearly detrimental to the bourgeoisie and certainly the working class of a substantial section of the Eurozone. In particular, we are talking about, of course, Greece, Italy, Spain, and Portugal. In the case of the Irish Republic, the situation is slightly different, but nonetheless, they're certainly in an extremely difficult position, which has continued. The fact is that at least five members of Doyle now belong to the far left, which is no coincidence. The other country which is not in the same financial difficulty is, of course, France, but the French have been issued an order to reduce their budget deficit, which is at below that 3%, that's to say, it is more than 3%, to bring it down to 3%. The European Commission has gone further, though, and the IMF has more or less repeated the demands. And what they are demanding of France is what they are demanding of the other countries as well. It amounts to a series of recipes to restoring capitalism to what it was before the Second World War. That's to say, they are demanding privatizations in particular, but a series of other demands of a similar kind. Now, of course, it is possible under these conditions of austerity, official austerity, to put forward these demands and get certain results. It's certainly been applied to Greece, and there have been tremendous demonstrations, fights, and so forth over it. The cost of doing so is well exemplified by Greece, where you get massive demonstrations and clearly the threat of more than demonstrations. And it's clear that the government is not supported by the majority of the population. Long term, the result from the point of view of capitalism in Greece is certainly disastrous. The result must be a growth of people who see themselves as militant opponents of capitalism, if not of the EU. So, the policy can only be described as stupid. It's even more stupid when we realize, as has been made very clear several times over, that there is no way on earth that the plan by which Greece is supposed to repay its debt can actually be carried out by 2020. It clearly can't be carried out, even though what is happening is a continuous squeeze. And even though what is happening is that the budget need no longer be in deficit. Clearly the debt which Greece owes to the rest of the EU, the IMF, etc., can never be paid as things stand. The policy, therefore, that has been adopted to Greece can only be described as self-defeating and crazy, looked at from the point of view of those who are imposing it, that is. Unless there's a further agenda, and I'll come to that in a few minutes. So, In the case of the other countries, what we are talking about here is two things, which are, of course, closely connected. On the one hand, what amounts to a possible sovereign bankruptcy, which has to be held at bay. That's to say, the countries involved, Italy, Spain, Portugal, will be unable to pay even the interest on the debt which they have borrowed from the so-called markets. The markets, of course, just amount to large capitals, sometimes private, sometimes consisting of insurance companies and banks, pension funds and so forth. At one point it was largely America. Today it's been more repatriated, as it were. Well, the problem arises because the word confidence is here used, that the owners of the capital who are lending the money to Italy, Portugal, Spain, etc., are afraid that they will not be repaid and therefore try to withdraw, and interest rates simply rise. Well, in practice, what's happened has been that there has been a certain amount released under what amounts to arcane arrangements of the Eurozone, largely backed by Germany, not entirely, but to a large extent backed by Germany. So these countries are then indebted to the EU itself, and ultimately to Germany. Behind their difficulties has been a connection with the banking crisis. In the case of Spain, that has been very obvious. In the case of Ireland, that seems to have been the actual cause of the crisis. Ireland didn't have the same indebtedness. So have a series of countries increasing, as it were, over the months, Cyprus being the last, which have had to apply for loans and which have then been in trouble. And the reason, in many cases, has been the role of the banks. And even where it wasn't a direct question of the banks having to be recapitalized, the banks nonetheless were in trouble. Well, it does seem, firstly, judging again by our articles in the Financial Times, particularly by Wolfgang Munchau, that the banks in Europe remain in trouble, that no solution has been provided. It was thought that there had been an attempt to get to a solution, that it would have gone somewhere, but it hasn't. So the banks in Europe, in other words, are not sufficiently funded, or if you want to put it like that. If tomorrow an accountant were to work through their books, they'd have to conclude that without loans from the government, they would be bankrupt. Now, that's the real position in Europe today. And it's not just the case the countries mentioned have trouble, that's that the banks in those countries have trouble. It's true of the other countries as well, including Germany. So the banking crisis has not been solved. It's not being dealt with. It remains. And that links very closely with the sovereign crisis. Well, question, of course, is why? Why is it the case that the bourgeoisie prefers, or if you want, the bureaucratic institutions, the IMF and the European Union, the European Central Bank, prefer to apply a policy of austerity wherever they can in order to squeeze the population almost to the wit's end? Why does it prefer to do this? The logic of it is that if it continues this way, what has happened in Greece will happen, but in a much larger scale, possibly even interconnected, over the countries of Europe. Even in the case of Germany, where the working class has been relatively quiescent, has accepted a series of anti-working class laws, has accepted controls over pay over the last decade or so, particularly with the Schroeder reforms, social democratic Schroeder reforms. Even there, you would expect the working class at some point to refuse to accept the controls over themselves. There's historic reasons why it is the case, but eventually one would expect them to begin to act too. Because if austerity is not applied in the same way, it is effectively a form of control over them, the German working class too. Well, the point then is that one will expect it, in not too distant a future, the ordinary person, whether in Spain or Italy or Portugal, to go beyond demonstrations, to go beyond simply voting for an opposition party, to go perhaps the way they've gone in Egypt or in Brazil or further. When one squeezes a population the way they've done it, that is almost certain to result. It may be, of course, that it will not happen in the next 2 or 3 years, but it may take 10 years or 12 years or whatever when a new generation of militants arises. But that will happen. And most people, whether they're left wing or right wing, recognize that that is the kind of result that you're going to get. And for that reason, of course, the European Union precisely recognized it almost in those words, and therefore relaxed its austerity program. It didn't remove it. It simply allowed payments to be over a longer period of time. So, the issue is there. But why are they continuing to do it like this? Why don't they simply fund the banks? Why don't they simply take the money, print the money? After all, you are not going to get the inflation that they're talking about. We're not in an inflationary period. Why don't they do it? Well, the answer in relation to the banks and funding, or simply the government spending the money, that's to say, extending its deficit and going for a boom rather than a downturn, the answer given is that you will get an inflation and it might be uncontrollable. And the usual reason then given is that somehow the Germans have been seared by the experience of 1923 and 1948, the period of the runaway inflations, and therefore they are insisting that they have to avoid it, and this is the only way to avoid it. This is just nonsense. This is simply nonsense. If anyone thinks that the conditions of 1923 apply today, then they've clearly never read their history. I have to remember what happened in 22-23 in Germany. There was the invasion of the Ruhr by France. There was, beginning in roughly March 23, a possible uprising or revolution. It was certainly the case that the Bolsheviks in Russia, Trotsky in particular, but not just Trotsky, were expecting a revolution in Germany. And even now, it's not at all clear why it didn't actually happen. There were a number of uprisings that happened in October. Now, just consider this. Here we have a situation in Germany which is highly unstable, which has just lost the war, where the economy is clearly in trouble, but in a much more fundamental way. And you have an inflation. Well, by the way, the Minister of Finance was Rudolf Hilferding, who, of course, was a long-time Marxist, though he had shifted somewhat politically. So, what happened in Germany in 1923, therefore, is in no way comparable. There's not a chance in hell that that will be repeated at the present time. So that can't be printed on anybody's mind because there's no conditions for it. 1948 is after the war. So again, when the country was bombed out. So the conditions are not there. For inflation, basically you have to have the kind that's been talked about, you have to have a shortage of resources and too much money. That's basically what you would have to have under present conditions. That's what you effectively had in Germany in the periods we're talking about. So, that isn't going to happen. And there's no reason to assume that's imprinted on every German's mind or on the mind of the bourgeoisie, since it's clearly nonsense. So that isn't the reason. They're not really worried you're going to get a massive inflation. And in fact, when they look around the world, they can see that isn't what's happening. After all, both Britain and America are printing money on a large scale. And inflation is low. And now, of course, Japan has gone in for it on an even bigger scale, and they're not getting the inflation involved. They're trying to get out of deflation. So the argument is nonsense. There has to be a fundamental reason why, in particular, the German bourgeoisie, and it is the German bourgeoisie, not just Merkel, want to go for this period of austerity, this period of greater control, a shift to 19th century forms, privatization, controls over labor, etc., etc. So, the answer ultimately is that we are in a new situation. We are in a situation where, as it were, all bets are off. There are, in fact, just two roads. There is this road being forced through, a road of control. That's what it boils down to. Even if they don't get to their desired end, they will establish a series of controls, which will amount to a defeat of the working class. Now, in my view, although this is what they want, they are most unlikely to get there. It's much more likely that if they pursue this path, they will end up in the way that I've just said, increasing working class protests, increasing working class action, and ultimately what amounts to a popular uprising. Much like as I said, much like in Egypt, or probably a new form, but which goes beyond Egypt without arms, at least to begin with. How it would proceed, no one knows. But that is very, very likely now, in a finite time, if they pursue the present policy to the end. But I can't see that happening because it's far too dangerous and it won't get there in that way. So, nonetheless, that appears to them to be their only path. I doubt if they've seen it to the end. Most likely what they see is that they will be able to go up to a certain point and halt it. And think that, even if it is a final defeat, or even a defeat, it will nonetheless be good enough to maintain control for a period of time. I think that is where they're going and that is what they want, because the alternative, which is that Germany effectively then provides the necessary funds by allowing something like euro loans, which will then get these the countries as a whole off the hook, and by allowing a banking union, which will get the banks off the hook, which ultimately is guaranteed by Germany and the German bourgeoisie. So if they do that, they're creating the possibility of increased working class control, of full employment, or perhaps not full employment, but moving towards greater levels of employment. And it will, given the circumstances, it will still mean a shift to the left. That's to say, without all the pressure. Given what has happened already. And they don't want that. They are afraid of that. And from their point of view, they are right to be afraid of it. So they prefer to take a stronger line. The election, which is shortly to happen in Germany, is unlikely to change very much, as has been pointed out. But it is probably true that if the Social Democrats come in with the Greens, and they then make limited concessions, not the whole concession, as it were, but limited concessions, they will probably find themselves on a path which they won't be able to leave. In other words, one concession will lead to another. And the logic would therefore be that they would go along a path in which Germany would indeed end up providing the euro loans and the guarantees necessary. But perhaps at a sufficiently low level that they are much less worried about what might come. However, that has its own logic, as I have been implying. And it could well mean that the logic, and it almost certainly would mean if they went along the path, and that the working class would begin to act as a class. Thank you.